Well, thank you, David. Thank you all. Those keen observers of the comings and goings of science ministers will notice that I'm now in the next phase of tracking my former mentor, David. I'm now aiming to become a heavyweight elder statesman of science and technology and hounding ministers as they come and go to insist on forward-looking policy. Let me just firstly say I'll be brief because there's some really important people here tonight and it's an important conversation. Firstly, just for those who, well, firstly to say, in the same way that if universities didn't exist, I think the finest minds in Whitehall would be saying, if only there were institutions, sovereign, free, deep-rooted institutions with heritage, history, culture that could train, teach, research, inspire, drive local economies, provide the pillars of an innovation economy. If only there were such a thing, how on earth could we create them? Fortunately, we have universities. We have some great universities, and they're a really important part of our ecosystem. In the same way, I think people would say, if only there was a foundation for science and technology, a place that could bring people together without any sense of corporate captive, vested interest, just to bring the finest minds in the land who really care about science and technology together to give a forum for ministers, but also for leaders in the sector and to drive the debate. And I just wanted to say that because the foundation has been a great champion and a great forum and a great force in this mission that I've sort of made my mission for the last 13 years with David in the beginning and then trying to do my best to pursue it in the last few years. So let me just say three things, something about how we got here, because I can, David, to answer your challenge. Something about Horizon and Pioneer. And there's a question hanging over all this, which is if we are going to be a global force, a global science and technology superpower, unpacked in the right way, then what's the right balance between Europe and the rest of the world? And then some reflections on what we've got to do now to really land this and take this deal and turn it into what it could be and to make this a big moment, not just to get back to where we were, but to go much, much further. So in order, reflections on how we got here. I think the first meeting I had 2 years ago when I returned to government was in this building. I think it was hosted, David, by you and or Greg Clark, Adrian, and many of you here tonight to talk about this very question. And it seemed to me that to go right back, when the trade continuity or the Brexit deal was being negotiated, it was an absolute red line for me and also for Boris Johnson at the time and Michael Gove and a number of others that whether you wanted to or not, we were leaving the political union, but we were absolutely not leaving the scientific, the cultural, the defense, the security unions. And in fact, if you're going to leave the political union, in my view and others, you need to redouble your commitment to the other institutions. And it was in that context that I came back into this role 2 years ago and was as appalled as you all were to see that actually, just to remind everyone, we did actually negotiate back in that Brexit deal in 2020 to be in Horizon, Copernicus, and Euratom. But I say that not to undermine the understandable, I think, irritation, anger in the European Union that a deal they thought they'd done in Northern Ireland was not honoured. And in that situation, they felt it was appropriate to weaponise Horizon to force everyone to focus on it. I can't, it's not for me to comment on whether that was the right decision, but it was a clear decision. And so it seemed to me that we needed to do two things. One, resolve Northern Ireland, which wasn't in my purview. But two, while that was being done, repairing the relationship with our European partners, we needed to do everything we could to prepare to get back into Horizon, to keep the flame of Horizon membership alive, to wear out the shoe leather in reassuring everyone across Europe that we did not want to leave, but we want to be back in. And but also to prepare for the potential eventuality that we couldn't. And I was quite surprised to find there was no plan B when I arrived at all. There was a single piece of paper, which was basically the three pillars of Horizon with the Union Jack on the top, which is not a plan B at all. And to be fair, Boris at the time said, there's no plan B then. I mean, really, how are we ever going to how are we going to... And he was right, actually. So it seemed to me we needed a proper plan B. And I called it plan B, by the way, because I wanted to remind everyone that plan A was to get back into Horizon as quickly as we could. But it also seemed to me an opportunity to ask some quite big questions that needed to be asked. And Adrian and others here had flagged that if we really intend to be a global player in the science and technology global race and a leader in deploying, harnessing science, research, technology and innovation, each different, to tackle the big global challenges and to attract billions into this country, then I think you do have to ask yourself, look over the 3 years of the total science budget, or the total R&D budget across government, $52 billion. The total, if you're front-loading a Horizon membership, $6 billion in, equalize it, $5 billion, say, over 3 years. Beyond Europe, global, about $500 million. Are those ratios... Now, I accept that a lot of that UK spend investment is global in nature as well. I'm not suggesting it isn't. But I think you do have to ask the question, does that feel right? Is that the right balance? So in doing the Pioneer piece, I wanted to ask, look, if we had to take that Horizon money and redeploy it, what could we do with it globally? And I was doing that partly because I felt we needed to do it, partly because it seemed to me that we might discover some things that we wanted to do in addition to being an active member of Horizon. And I hope that there are some things in that Pioneer prospectus that future governments will look at and say, we should do that as well. Just to complete your challenge of how did we get here, as I said to the House of Lords Science and Technology Committee yesterday, by the way, Parliament at its best, a completely private conversation between some pretty eminent peers on the Science and Tech Committee and the former minister in private. George, your reflections on where we are, how we got here. And that is Parliament working at its best, totally non-partisan, deep conversation, lessons learned that will be recycled anonymously back to ask the next minister. So I just share that with you because it was something that doesn't get seen in our system. And they were asking the same question, how did we get here? And I'll make the point now that I made to them, that it seemed to me that in January 22, it was pretty obvious to me, looking at the Horizon program, three pillars, the talent pillar, ERC, the second pillar, the global and the industrial, and then the third, innovation. Pillar one is completely essential. Well, I forget the exact numbers, we had over 130 top professors here, ERC professors. When two or three of them started saying to me, George, the EU are ringing me up saying, if we're not in, I've got to go back. That's a disaster. And it seemed to me that we absolutely had to set out a really big, bold reassurance that if they didn't want to go, we would match that with a big fellowship program. But more than that, that we actually need to take the opportunity to address, I think, some quite structural weaknesses in our early, mid and late stage ecosystem. I think we're taking our research community for granted. And the old model, the junior doctor model of you're on the rat wheel of grant applications, and eventually you might become a professor and then you'll be on the rat wheel of grant applications. And it's not attractive for people. It's not productive. And when I met, some of you have heard me say this, that brilliant young biomedical scientist, she was 29 from Oxford. I met her at the Max Planck Institute and she'd just been awarded their big fellowship, 10-year funding for her and a postdoc and a technician and a discretionary budget, and the choice of all the Max Planck Institutes. Pretty attractive. And I said, tell me, had you always wanted to move to Germany? She said, I never wanted to move to Germany, but who can resist this? And quite soon she'll have a German partner and a German family, and she's our loss, and I can't blame her. So it seems to me that we, in that Horizon Pioneer Pillar One, I was also trying to say, look, we really do need to think about whether we shouldn't have a much stronger fellowship offer. And I hope some of that some of it has already come through in the autumn statement. Of course, the Treasury, if you're going to do long-term fellowships, you need to endow them. Treasury like three-year funding. I don't think anyone else does. I think if you're going to do science and technology seriously as a nation, three-year funding doesn't cut it. And fellowships certainly need to be longer. And I think the withdrawal of the welcome, or partial withdrawal of the welcome from the fellowship space, has left a bit of a gap. So I think that's a really important part of the pillar. Pillar two I looked at, and of course we have a different structured economy from France and Germany, but it's basically Rolls Royce and then hundreds of companies I've never heard of. And the Rolls-Royce participation wasn't huge. It was a fraction of their R&D. Whereas in France and Germany, you're looking at 30, 40, 50 big regional, national, global players, big engineering businesses for whom Horizon is a major part of their existence. We don't sadly have that kind of economy anymore. But I just make that observation that there weren't that many big corporates involved. So I turned to Pillar 3. I thought, well, we'll Hoover up there, obviously, as an innovation economy. And there, it was very striking. There were lots of tiny little SMEs, but not that many commercial companies growing at scale. And the reason, really, when you ask them is, well, it's basically an academic process. You have to fill in lots of forms to do the academic thing. It's not really designed for small companies. It was quite striking. We weren't getting very good return rates there either. So hence Pioneer, three pillars, a big talent piece, a big industry innovation piece. And it seemed to me that we could then attract, put some money into different sectors, use it to leverage in co-investment. If you industry in agri-tech, in clean tech, in space, in fusion, in robotics, if you'll put some money into a program, we'll 50-50 it. We'll make it much more attractive. And on the innovation pillar, similarly, make it something that really catalyzes, more like a catalyst fund that would really drive much stronger SME and investor engagement. How many VCs, investors in S&T, had Horizon companies in their portfolio? Very few. And they weren't even thinking about it. Unlike when I was a VC, we always had a smart award. We always, because they were easy, simple, clear, reliable, well-structured. Whereas Horizon's designed for poor academics who are used to filling in endless forms. So that was my thinking behind Pioneer. And I think there's some stuff in there that is very relevant to the landscape reviews, to the Nurse, to Kell grant reviews, to making that our research ecosystem much more globally competitive, the Formula One engine that you would have heard me talk about. If China's at 260 billion, America's at 300 billion a year, and we're going to 20, great, but it had better be into a Formula One engine of efficiency and impact, and it isn't yet. So I was thinking that the Pioneer program would help us to do that, but also help us to deepen those international collaborations both in Europe and beyond. And while we were negotiating, it seemed to me that I should go immediately to the powerhouse R&D economies, the small nations that pack a punch in R&D, Switzerland, Israel, Japan, countries who are not in the Washington, Beijing, or Brussels group, but want to have deep alliances and have got really strong R&D. They welcomed us with open arms, and I've negotiated big strategic framework agreements, Pillar 1 discovery, Pillar 2 industry incentive innovation, Pillar 3 government diplomacy, regulation, skills, and all of that stuff. So, and I was doing that partly thinking, well, if we're not in Horizon, then those would provide structures and frameworks that we could repeat. And I'm delighted we then did that same structure for Canada. And I was just in the process of getting it going for France, Germany, Italy. And by the way, in each of those, Pillar 1 and 3, we're going to have secondments and exchanges, because it seems to me if you're going to be back in Horizon without free movement, boy, we need to make it much easier for talented researchers across Europe to come into our system. So that was the thinking. That's my sort of second piece, the thinking around Pioneer. And I would just make this observation in Liberation, David, that it seemed to me blindingly obvious by about the end of February that that's what we should do. And the Treasury, in my view, took the view, not so fast. We'd rather take a bit of time and we'll claw back some money. And I think we could have been much speedier to deploy that money into the fellowships, into some of those industry collaborations, into some of those catalyst funds. And it seemed to me that it rather suited the Treasury to move rather more slowly. And is this public? Well, perhaps you could be discreet. Okay. So I to be fair to the Treasury, they face a huge and horrendous problem in managing the public finances. And the instinct can be to constrain public spending by taking time to approve the funding. And David, when I returned to government, said, you'll be amazed, things that we used to approve in 9 months are now taking 2.5 years. It's a serious problem. Now, whether that's by accident or design, if you want to move at pace at S&T and be globally competitive, it isn't working. And so I think we missed a trick. We could have launched Pioneer in that Q1 of 22. And I would have said to the EU, look, we're desperate to come back, really keen. But while we're out, we're not just going to be benched. We'll deploy this money. And anything we deploy, obviously, will have to come off the bill, the re-entry bill. And the quicker you get on the phone and the quicker we can agree, the better for everyone. I think it would have helped the negotiation a bit as well. But anyway, didn't happen. And then when the deal was done, I think the last thing I'd say is, having been Minister for Fusion, it was very interesting to me that actually Ian Chapman and the team at UKAEA said, look, to be honest, the Euratom programme, we've been lucky enough to host it for 40 years. In the next phase, ITER is a huge project. If we're going to go for a moonshot, try and be the first country to deploy fusion industrially, Ian's advice to me and the team was, they're going to ring us up every week anyway to ask what to do. If you can get the money out of your asset and put 650 million into a moonshot race for industrial fusion, we might really be able to pull this off. It's a punt, but I think it's a smart move. So for any of you who are wondering why out of your atom, it was completely deliberate. And I didn't think at first we'd be able to negotiate. The EU don't like, you know, cherry picking. So actually, to be fair to the Treasury, I think we ended up, although we lost a year, we ended up in a place that, not least because of the way they structured the deal, the EU very, very keen to signal that they want us back. It's not just a sort of an agreement in name, but not in effect. They actually want us back. And I think that's partly because of our allies and friends across Europe. And I thank all of you who mobilized those friends. And Ursula von der Leyen and the Prime Minister have a very strong working relationship. And the deal is they'll basically guarantee that we get back what we used to get back. And we can now get back up to 108% of our contributions. And that's huge. So that brings us to the last bit. What do we do now? Firstly, I think it liberates UK Ryan Ottolien, who've been doing amazing work preparing to launch this whole vast Pioneer programme. We can park it. I think we can get back to the core business of making our system more competitive. And on Horizon, to wrap up, huge opportunity, not just to get back to what we were doing, but ergo following from the points I've made, I think to get sectors, all of these high growth sectors, clean tech, agri-tech, space, fusion, quantum, engineering, biology, to be actively thinking, do we have a Horizon program? Are we encouraging all of our researchers and companies to be in it? And secondly, our investor community. If you're not actively supporting and asking your researchers, why not? And the answer was, well, it's quite complicated. It's rather academic. So we've agreed to set up a unit supported by some big corporates and some of the leading university folk who know how to fill in the forms as a support house to help companies access this money. So I will close this by saying, I think we've got an opportunity to not just get back into Horizon, key though that is, but to make this a moment where in 5 years, people look back and say, well, we didn't get back in. Actually, we got all the high growth sectors committed. They all promoted it. And next year, the phone rang and Europe said, we got a problem. You're heading for 120% of your contributions. That's where we want to get to. And I think we could get quite quickly there as long as HMG and the sector really pick it up and run with it. I'll stop there, David. Thank you very much for this conversation. And I'm really looking forward to your thoughts.